Dorothy, when she asked me to speak, it is an honor for me to be here. You people have supported me from the very first day that I started this project. And I'm grateful for that. And last month, Social Justice Council gave us some of the money that you take away from the people who come here. And we're very grateful for that, too. It amounted to over $1,500. And thank you. Thank you very much. When Dorothy asked me, would I like to speak, I had to sort of snicker to myself, because asking an Irishman would he like to talk is like asking an alcoholic would he like a drink. And that really is the case, for those of you who didn't know. There are some handouts. One is this one. It's notes on the notes. This is a demographic transition. My student assistants will be handing these out. Won't you, student assistant? Anyway, this thing here is important. It's important, not the piece of paper is important, but the idea is important. As countries have become developed, they have lessened, they have reduced the death rate. And this has happened through the centuries, through the millions of years. And as the crude death rate decreases, as a country becomes developed and they put in health services and education comes around and curses us, and we learn not to put dirty things in our mouths or the mouths of our children, as these things occur, the death rate decreases. And for a while, the birth rate, which paralleled it, goes along at the old level. And then it begins to drop to parallel the death rate. So what does this mean? It means that if we look back on our own population, and we look back at our father's generation and the grandfather's generation, you see the bigger families in the past. People were compensating for children that died because of illness. And so in the European countries and the other developed countries, as the death rate decreases, so the birth rate decreases. So I felt I needed to explain that, because one of the most important things that we do in our project is reduce the death rate of babies, which we have done phenomenally. The infant mortality rate, which is the number of babies that die before their first birthday, for every 1,000 children born, has decreased from the rate where we started, which is 101. That's like 10% of the babies died before their first birthday, to a little over 20 now. Now, we'll reduce this, we hope, in the future. But I think it is significant that I'm telling you and can tell you these rates, because there are many kinds of development agencies, and most of them do not measure what they do. But we do, and strictly adhere to this. Before we start a project, we establish what the rates are, the rates of death, the rates of illness, the rates of malnutrition. The severely malnourished children in this colony, when we started, we measured that in 2004, and we discovered or uncovered that 87% of the children under 5 years of old age were severely malnourished. Now that's a high number anywhere, even in an Indian slum where bad health rates are at their worst. This we have reduced to less than 24, and still going down. But my point in telling you this and telling these rates is that I do urge you, when you look at your donating money to development agencies, that you look at those who publish their rates. their rates of, what are the rates of improvement? Because some of the very respectable, or looking very respectable agencies, do not do this. And to our detriment, because we're putting money on a dead horse. And some of these you don't know about, but the rates are there if you delve for them. For example, American Red Cross. One thinks of that as a sterling organization. It's been going a long time. It has very, very good intentions, and it does some good work. It's true. What is its beneficiary rate? That is to say, how much of its money reaches the beneficiary in benefits? For the American Red Cross, the last number I saw published was 5%. That means you give the American Red Cross $100, and 5 of it does some good. To me, this is horrifying, but it is very, very well supported and a very rich organization. Another organization that started at the same time as mine is World Vision. World Vision is a religiously supported organization, and I've seen it overseas and worked alongside it, and they do some good work, it's true. But what does the CEO get as a salary? It's involved in a little scandal recently where it is seen that the CEO's salary is $465,000 a year. My salary in the last, 13, 14 years in Chandigarh so far has been $6,000 a year. Now, it does cover my postage stamps and lunches for January. And I do hope as we get more money, I will get some salary. But it's not necessary because the rewards I get are tremendous. And some of them I'm going to tell you about. So now you know all about the demographic transition. And you know what to say when people say to you, well, this organization is reducing death rates of babies, so that means there's an increase in the world's population, and we can't afford that. And that's right. But what other way is there to do it? And the increase in babies is really not that much, because it will reduce as we solve some problems. If you see any of these things sitting around, will you please take it home? They're out of date, and we can't get rid of them. I want you to look at this little bit of paper, which is about development. I should warn you at first that this is a 2.5-hour talk, and I'm sorry, I can't do anything about that. This piece of paper here asks us, what is a developed nation? Well, we know what that is. It's an industrial nation, isn't it? It's mostly Christian, isn't it? And what is it? Filled with nice people and doing nice things. And most everybody has a job or the promise of one or a dole from a benevolent government. But we don't think much about it. We know what a developed nation is. It's one with an industrial deposits and all kinds of crud and lying politicians and all things like that. We know what it is. But we really haven't thought much, have we? Or most people haven't, about what development is. Well, if we were to give this talk its full benefit, I would take suggestions from you as to what it might be. But, let's take one or two anyway. What is development?
Improvement.
Any suggestions?
Improvement in life circumstances.
Okay. That's an idea. What's development? Yes, sure.
Taking beneficial use of resources.
Mm-hmm. That's an idea.
Research.
Okay. So it is many, many things. When I started, I used the word development for, 80 times a day since 1968 when I started in this business. But I really hadn't worked out what development is, because it seems to be in so many guises. And when I was setting up this organization, I wanted to use it in its title, but then I wasn't sure what I was talking about. So I couldn't come up with a definition that pleased me. And the definition of a developed nation is not that envious. So I worked at understanding it. And I went to the meaning of the word, went to the Oxford English Dictionary to see if that could help me understand, to come up with a good definition so I could use it in our title and really mean it and believe in it. And in the etymology, I discovered that it has evolved from an early French word. And it's related to a word that we use very, very commonly. The word is envelope. Envelope, the thing you put bills in and sell to your neighbors and things like that. That's an envelope. It is something, and then we use envelope as a verb where you put something inside something else. You envelop it. And then in the early French, they had a word for taking it out of where it was developed. And we call that des, D-E-S, D-E-S, the opposite of envelope. It's desvelop. And so desvelopment is the taking out of this thing. And I thought, Eureka, that's exactly what I want. I don't want us smart people going into some nation and telling them how to live and telling them how to produce fossil emissions and things like that to kill themselves with ulcers and stress and all kinds of things. That's not it. That's not what I want to do. What I really want to do is to go into a country and somehow disenvelop, to bring out what is within the country already, what merits there are, what demerits there are, but get out what is there. I thought about how do I do that. Excuse me. And when I looked at all the efforts that we've done in development and how many billions of billions of billions of billions of dollars that we have put into development since 1945, when we noticed that some nations needed some help, and so we decided to help them. Mostly we're trying to make them look more like us. That was our idea for development. If the country looks like ours, that's developed. Oh yeah, that's developed. But maybe there are some things deep within the country that need to be disenveloped, to be brought out. And so that's how I use it in the title, and that's how I think about it. And I can live with that. That makes sense to me. It's not something that's being imposed. It's something that's being disenveloped. Related very closely, discover. Discover, you can see the connection there, can't you? It's taking away the cover. So, anyway, we got that out of the way. And what else do we need to say? So, what are the worst problems in a developed nation? So, Winnie, what are they? What's the worst problem in a developed nation? A developing nation? Right. I would tend to agree with you. It's easier to agree on what the worst problems are. Any other suggestions? What do you think is the worst problem in a developing nation? Uh-huh. Thank you. Right on. Oh, thank you very much. So, they're very easy to discover, or disenvelop, because we've studied them to the ground. And typically we agree that the worst single problem is the sickness and death rates of young children and other vulnerable groups. See, the most vulnerable groups that we define are women in childbirth years and in childbirth, babies, and the younger they are, the more vulnerable they are to early death, and so on. But that's where we begin, and we say that's the worst problem. What's the second worst problem? Most people have decided, most people who are in development have decided that it's lack of education, because that seems to be the key to an awful lot of things. It's a key to solving some of the problems. It's a key to solving their own problems in their own homes. And the third group of problems that we see in developing nations that we've decided are very serious are lack of income. It isn't just lack of money this afternoon. It's lack of income, of a steady flow of money coming in. The first one is incredibly important, and the longer I've worked with it, the more I'm convinced it's incredibly important. That's health, lack of health. And the severe malnutrition that I've come across in developing countries has got more effects and more results than I had imagined when I started in this business. And with malnutrition, as you'll see some children here, these are children nearly all from India, but a few from Pakistan. And natural hair color there is jet black. And people who are healthy have lovely, shiny black hair. You'll see in some of these photographs children with streaks of blonde and some blonde in it. This is not a genetic change. This is lack of protein. These are children with a terrible diet who nearly 100% are now or will become not so well in the head, handicapped in terms of cognitive abilities. So malnutrition just isn't being underweight and having low defenses and a low immunity system. It isn't just that. It's the ruination of a life through not getting enough food of the proper kind in the early days. I would like to dismiss, if it is in your mind, that poor people have a poor diet because they can't afford it. In this slum I'm working in, and in slums in India, you're working with some of the poorest people in the universe. And very few people in our community. We serve a community of 19,340 3 weeks ago, which is growing slowly and steadily. We serve these people on a daily basis. Excuse me. And I'm running. Oh, my wife says I should drink. Excuse me. So I see I'm running way behind. I've been asked to point out that the spelling of Chandigarh was spelled once or twice incorrectly in the newspapers, and then now it's become universal bad spelling. But anyway, the spelling's here, and if you look up the bad spelling, you won't find that country, that place in India. It's not there. So what have we covered? We know what development is and things like that. And you know what the demographic transition is. And we know that I'm behind my schedule. So I'll start on this talk here, and my student assistant will click on the machine. Oh, yes. What do I do to tell you to move? Click, click. So here's Jantakalni, a slum on the outskirts of Chandigarh. See the correct spelling? Oh, God, it's gone ahead. and we're looking at roofs. Now, this is a permanent settlement. These people own the land on which they built their shacks. Everybody built his own shacks. There are no regulations. The streets start and end and bend and twist, and from some are 10 foot wide and some are 4 foot wide. The people, when they build a house, they have no idea of construction, and when everything's going fine, they know how to put bricks together, and you get up to the top, and then you say, how do you put the roof on? Oh, so you put logs across, the limbs from trees across, and you put corrugated iron, most of which comes from the dump, where it's all in fragments. And you put it on, but how do you keep it on? So you go and get rocks and things and put them on top of that. So some people are doing very well with rocks and some people not so well. And so sometimes when we have high gales, these lift off as they go up. Next, please. Here is a street. Now, this is how it looked when we went there. All blurred, see? and this is sewer, open sewer, going up the middle of the street. And I say this is a DRR triumph because I made acquaintance with the district commissioner. That's the government official in charge of this area. And it's not a small job. He's in charge of the city of Chandigarh. So I made acquaintance with him and had him come out and see this Busty. Yeah, Busty, named for a community, but mostly slum community. So I had him come out and see this, and I pleaded with him to have this drain, this sewer, put underground. And so he did. And so the slide which shows the road that's now put in, and it's lightly tarmacadamed, but is it tremendous, for me, a tremendous triumph. And the other slide is, the good slide is lost, so you'll have to take my word for it that it is indeed underground.
So and the rubble there that you see?
I'm sorry?
Under the rubble right here, so the pipeline is under the rubble.
Oh, just throw things in there. And then the local people took the idea that it is a place where you dump things. So old broken bicycles and car tires and things like that are put in there, which used to block it up. Now they have a hard time getting that rid of that and blocking up the sewers. Here is one of our not so friendly animals that walk around the place. I was very apprehensive of getting rid of them or trying to get rid of them because I thought it would produce hardship on the people, because this is the only business I see going there in the whole city, the whole slum. But I discovered that we did a survey. I had my staff go out and count these. We went through the whole community and we came up with this number. And the ownership of these pigs, almost 100%, they belong to rich people who don't live in the slum. But they hire 18-year-old boys as pig herds. And these boys will look after their pigs and lock them up at night and see that they don't get stolen. And they don't have to feed the pigs, because the pigs can go in the open sewers and eat feces and every vile thing you can imagine. And the sale of them when they grow up and put on weight is terrific for these rich people who live outside. So that's something we tried to put an end to, and this population is vastly improved now. Here is my field staff. We have two types of staff. We have staff that work every day in the community, going from house to house, and then there's the senior staff. The senior staff are trainers. These people in order to be on the field staff in DIR, you have to live in a slum. So these people are all nearly 100% were born in the slum. Slum has been there over 45 years. Nearly all were born there. But anyway, they have to come from there. The trainers come from outside because I have normally, we're short of staff at the moment, but normally I have two MDs, one chief administrator, one or two nutrition specialists. I say specialists, they're people with at least a master's in nutrition. So here we are. Health promoters, that's the most of the field staff, have 2 hours of academic training daily. The first is in nutrition, one is in nutrition, and one is in medicine. And here we are dealing with a not-quite-killed person. And here's Natasha, went by quickly. And Vina, who has been with me now 9 years. Most of the staff, when they come, they stay. I discovered very good people. Very good people.
Is teaching language English? No.
We have English classes occasionally. We have a system of internships. So these are people who come from all over the world except Pitcairn Islands, and they spend between 4 and 12 months with us. Usually there are people who are, usually the students, and they're taking a year off after their bachelor's degree before they go to work or before they go into graduate study. Mostly they're students. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes there are people that have finished their professional training, but they want experience overseas. Okay.
In the medical classes or the nutrition classes, they are taught in their own languages. Frederick is the only foreigner, other than the interns.
But my point about talking about interns is when we have an intern that speaks English, then we have English classes for the staff. Because it allows them, it isn't because it's a superior language and everybody should speak English. That's true, but that's not the reason. Oh yes, so what is the reason? The reason is so they can look at texts, because there are not many good texts in the subjects that we want people to learn. Sorry.
From your description, is this a kind of international Peace Corps? I mean, it's very specific, but in the Peace Corps for Americans going there, but it sounds like an international group who comes to learn.
You mean the adventure group?
Yes.
Yes, it is, but on a very, very small scale. Usually we don't have more than one or two.
Oh, okay.
At the moment we have no interest.
Okay.
But the possibilities are people
but it's international.
And then call us in.
Frederick, I was going to say that it's not like at all like the Peace Corps, or even like VISTA, which those are almost entirely made up of people from outside the community going into some other community and then leaving it. And what is being done here is entirely with people from the community. And I think that's what's distinctive and very important to keep in mind.
Yes, well, that's right. Thank you very much. Where do we go from that?
So it looks like she's got a blood pressure cuff and a scale.
Sorry?
It looks like she's carrying a blood pressure cuff and a scale.
Yes.
Yeah. So in the home, just they can weigh people to check blood pressure.
Yeah. Every family that has a child less than 5 years of age, they're looked at very closely for nutritional status. And so one of these measures of nutrition is the weight for age. And it's one of the first indicators and very reliable. So every child under 5 is weighed. That is put on records that we have and put on records in the home of the child, and it is explained to the mothers and the parents of the children about nutrition and how to improve it and so on and so forth. We have surveyed all adults for tension, hypertension and hypotension, and discovered people who were ill and didn't know it, or needed some assistance and didn't know it. Normally, the people in some don't seek health care because it's by law it's provided free in government hospitals, but they're treated very poorly and seen as dirty people, many of whom are, because not every home has water, and as you see in these photographs here, there isn't spotlights on them which show them up clearly, but do look at the number of children and the number of people who are dirty. Their faces are dirty, their hands are dirty. It's not that they want to be, it's that water is not there and it's difficult to get to.
Could you go back to that slide for a second, Roberta? Talking about sewage, open sewers, you'll notice at the bottom left of this photo that it's all black. That's an open sewer.
That's
at the edge of a road, and so they just put some slab concrete walk to make walkways from the home to the middle of the street. And
those,
whenever you have black water, you know.
For those of you who don't know my friend who's giving me some help from the back, that's Bob. He was in the Peace Corps in India. So he knows what he's talking about and can help me here. And yes, these are open sewers. And the slush from the families who live inside, they just put it out and it gets there. Then it's not their problem anymore. So what are we looking at? We're looking at malnutrition. We're looking at HPs going around, weighing people. And routine blood and pressure checks. And there we are. Immunization coverage rate. That means, we speak of coverage rate, that a person who, if we had 100% coverage rate, it would mean that every person in the community who is due to have shots has had them. It doesn't exist anywhere I know in the world. We have got to 99%, and I'm boasting, and that's the best I've seen, and it's the best I've been able to achieve anywhere. To give you ideas, what is our aim in California? What is the aim of the health department in terms of coverage, immunization coverage? Do you know what it is? I don't know what it is today, but it used to be, when I was connected with them, it used to be 85%. That's what they aim for. It's very hard to get because, some parents don't care, some people aren't educated, and some people don't believe in it, and a variety, and some religions forbid it. Just like your religion, it forbids a lot of things, doesn't it? Oh, yes, this brings me to a statistic that we have just discovered. We've just proven that our collection of statistics were correct for last year on this subject. Last year was the first year, 2016, that no woman died in the, how do you say it, reproductive years. This means that no woman died between the ages of 15 and 45, the reproductive years. No woman died in childbirth. What else? And then a very big surprise. So, as I say, we've just proven this, because when we come up with good statistics, I don't like to quote them unless I'm absolutely sure, because it's disastrous to be discovered to have told lies in this business. So I've just discovered this, and so when I go back, one of the first things I will look into is the death rate for all the other years between now and 2004. because then I can produce a chart and say that we improved from A to B. But just to get a zero on this is staggering. And tremendous accolade, reward for the workers and their work. I'm responsible for the design of the program, but for the implementation of the program has been 100% from the people themselves, which, as you see, if you read these, did I say you should take, if you find one of these around, would you take it home, please? They're out of date, and we need to get rid of them. So there we are. This is another organization we have. It reminds one a bit of but the Boy Scouts or the Guides or whatever. There's nothing for children in Islam. As you can see, you know, in poor countries elsewhere, or not so wealthy countries elsewhere, you can play in the street. But you can't play in a street that's 4 foot wide and it's got a 4 foot wide with a sewer in it. And anyway, they don't have balls and bats and things like that anyway. So we started this organization for children in the afternoon. And two things deliberately occur. God knows what happens accidentally. But the things that we plan for is to educate the children on essential things about life, like how to poison yourself or not poison yourself, how to clean your fingernails when you don't have a file and you don't have scissors, how do you do things like that. And then we have games. And some of the games are just straight fun games, and then some of the games are skill promoting games. For example, soccer is a popular game in India, and some of the games that we have promoted, if you play these games, your foot skills improve, and so on and so forth. So some days it's just all fun, and some days it's education, important, usable education, and so on. Very popular. One of the reasons it's popular, it's the only show in town. You know, we had absolutely no competition whatsoever. Here we are. The nutritionists give demonstration. We have a demonstration kitchen in our center, and the nutritionists do demonstrations of very cheap meals with very highly nutritive diet formula. And then the HPs go out and they demonstrate these. Maybe they'll do a demonstration to a street. They go into someone's house with their approval, of course, and those women will ask all the women down the street to come in into the house. And those are small houses and they're crowded. But they do a demonstration in all of these outlying areas. So, very practical way of getting good diet out to the people, and very, very closely looking at seasonal prices of food, how it goes up and down with the harvesting seasons, and coming up with new ideas. And an interesting thing that caught my eye was that almost universally people came to us when they had adopted new diets, and they said something that truly surprised me, and that was that now we're using less money for food than we did before. So this is very important to bear in mind, that malnutrition is not a function of poverty. It is not at all that. So, in Islam and in other slums and in poor communities, There often has been what we and the developed nations describe with derision, apathy. You know, the people are living in bad conditions, and they say we're living in bad conditions. I've been in homes when a monsoon was on and the roof is leaking. And I say, or somebody says, the roof is leaking, and the people who live there say, yeah, the roof is leaking. Total acceptance. Total, 100% acceptance. A leaking roof, you know. So we have these pools of water. These are very convenient for the mosquitoes and for nobody else. And we have horrible diseases. We have malaria is just one of them. We've had dengue fever, which is not good news at all. And usually the second time around on dengue fever, first time it hurts. It's called breakbone fever. And it feels like every bone in your body is broken. You just ache. I mean, on a pain level of 1 to 10, you're on 10 most of the time. That's dengue fever. And the second time you get it, it's common. Something like 50% or so of the people who get it the second time die. And there isn't much we can do about that. We don't know how to treat it, unless you do it with painkiller pills and the like. But it's not nice. I've just had it once so far. So here we are, and we're looking at these pools where mosquitoes thrive very nicely. And an educated person going in for the first time said, why don't the people drain these? It's easy to do. You're not in totally flat land. It tilts one way. You just dig trenches with your shovel. Almost everybody has a shovel. And it drains away. Well, you know, it's like the roof leaking. It's been there so long, and I'm not eating very energetic foods, and all kinds of things. Besides, it's just easier to sit there. So our people, we managed to get some money for shovels and spades, and we set about creating an example. And we didn't tell the people to look, and we didn't tell the people what we're doing. We just did it. And what happened? A lot of other people started doing it too. And this is, to me, is incredibly important, because it is people saying to themselves, I can do something. I can really do something. And that's the key to a whole lot of development. You know, I'll read this. And here, the two chaps on the bottom right, our new interns, arrived that day. Next. And so this is Andrew, who in private life is a medical student. And he has got a lot of information that he can pass on to our people. And he has digested this information so new that the vocabulary of speaking to the people here is very much easier than if we had one of our MDs. They are so speaking their own language that they're almost not understood at all by the local people. Yes.
I'm having a hard time about the
malnutrition. Here comes the mic.
Oh, good. You say that they have not been eating properly because they're poorly educated about nutrition. And I'm wondering what they're eating now that they haven't been eating before. And you're saying it's very cheap. I'm thinking of Mexico. They eat nopales, as their green vegetable every single day of their lives. I can't believe that there's not an income problem with the food. Just sell me that again, that idea.
Yes. No. I'm lost here.
Can I say something?
Yes, please do.
I've been out sometimes with the health promoters when they go to visit the families and talk to the mothers. And the mother will, you know, and here's a malnourished child, quite thin. And the mother says, well, all he ever will eat is biscuits, which is cookies, and chips, which they can buy in the slum for almost nothing. Little packets of chips or little packets of cookies. And, you know, a couple of rupees. And so the mother's busy, so she sends the kids out to, you know, get that sort of thing. So it's poor choice, which we know about in this country often. And so what they're doing now is vegetables, more vegetables that the nutritionist is putting together into interesting and tasty things. She's not making up new things necessarily, but she's using the locally available things. And then they, you know, eventually those kids are going to get, you know, if the mothers are convinced, don't buy chips and cookies for them anymore, you know, they will continue. And also there's a program where some of those very malnourished children are brought to the DIR center during the week, and they are given an egg and some fruit and so forth. That's the really badly malnourished ones. Sorry.
Thank you, Roberta, very much. All right, so we talk about cultural evenings. A cultural evening, again, it's like some of our programs, it's the only game in town. So we, there's no cinema, of course, there's no theater, there's nothing. So we hire a stage on the outskirts or in Chandigarh for the plenty of stages, or we go to a university auditorium and borrow it, legally, if you want it, and we put on public.
Yeah, he's spoken twice. I don't think he's.
In these things, they do some classical folk dancing. I was lucky enough to meet a person in the city who was a skilled choreographer. And so she taught them some Punjabi dances and some Rajasthani dances. And they had never done this before, never thought of it before. But they did it, and a lot of them love it and like to put on a cultural evening. So we put on a cultural evening, and the program will have some skits about eating or about immunization or about having too many babies or some practical idea that is worthy of the people having. And then they have just sheer fun things as dancing and some puppet shows as well. Oh, yes? Thank you. Very important. Very important. When they put on a skit or a play, they write the script for this. This is something I've never done before, never had an opportunity to do before. And they're gifted people in there with things to be developed. Oh yes, here we are. So, as I said, in a developing country, when you go in with our Western eyes and we look at the thing and we say, what's wrong here? What are the worst problems? And we said the first worst problem is health. And the worst part about health is nutrition. The second worst is immunization and so on. But then, what are the other worst problems? The worst, I said, was medical. The second is education, lack of education. And the third was income production. So let's talk a little bit about education here. In Chandigarh, India, as you know, was under Her Majesty's protection for the last 150 years. But isn't anymore. But So the very best schools in India, if you wanted to do well in the British civil service or in colonial circles, you had to have fluent English. So, and this is still a tremendous advantage for people in India. And the best schools are all taught in English. And the best families in Chandigarh speak in English. They also speak in Punjabi. But Punjabi is almost like a second language to these upper crust people. And their command of English and their vocabularies would be superior, most of them superior to mine if we're talking about adults. So, but how do you get into one of these elite schools if it's in English? Because nobody, no adults in the colony are speaking English, and they're not speaking English at home. So there are admission tests for children. Children at 4 and 5 taking a test to get into school. But that's the only way you can do it. So I started this school, and we now have a pre-primary school which is taught in English. And they are able to pass the test to get into these elite schools. There's hardly any problem with scholarships for these kids, but getting in is hard to do. How many do we have? Last time I counted, we had 81 children that we had passed the exams and were in these schools. And they're good schools. And when people come out of them, they're in very good shape in terms of economics and getting a good job. So where do we open there? So this is in our school. And look at the children. Aren't they beautiful? So what happens, we got to the stage where we got kids into the good schools, and then we lived so far away from the good schools that their parents couldn't afford transportation. The way to get around, of course, is rickshaw. But they couldn't afford rickshaw. So what are we to do? So I went along and begged a couple of corporations, and both of them very nicely gave us recreation vehicles. We call them school vans. And so these kids are now been taken to school for the children who can't afford. Look how clean they are. And of course they get school uniforms. I have got friends who are administrators or headmasters, and they help me get second-hand uniforms for these kids, which they must have in school. And so they look like everybody else in school. So in income generation, we have various skills that are taught to the people who are unemployed. One of the important things for women, and women are the most unemployed, of course, are these products. They're in a tailoring class, and you can see some of the things that they've made here. These are salwars or harem pants over there, and you know the bottle of wine, container, all these things. So this is the very first skill that these people are getting. And some of them are getting jobs, and some of them have set up their own dressmaking situation at home. They don't have money for sewing machines, and so we have to, when they make money, they get, these sewing machines are primitive. God, they're the worst I've ever seen. You crank them, you know, so you can only work with one hand, and this is one such machine. I learned to sew on a treadle machine, which worked very well for me. But to set in a buttonhole with no hands and cranking like this and turning the cloth around, it's hard. So when these people have made a salwar or made one of these, it's heroic, you know. It's a big deal.
They get paid for each piece as they make it. It's like when they made the first sort of iPad bag or a pair of pants, they're paid on the spot. And then when we sell them, any proceeds go back into health writers. This is the last slide.
So, would you hold it for a moment, please?
Yes, hopefully.
Could you move back one, please?
Oh, yes. This thing is on a timer. That's why it's been jumping ahead.
Yes. So, because we're talking about this, so what do we do for cloth? With the salwars and the harem pants, we buy the cloth. And the beautiful cloth is Indian, very, very reasonable price, much more reasonable than here. And fine printing, it's good cloth and it's good printing and it's all homemade. We have to buy those. For all the other products that we have here, I get the cloth given to me free. How do I do that? I have these friends of mine who work in textiles, either manufacturing, weaving plants, or in retail stores. So, inevitably, at the end of every year, they have swatches of cloth, samples of cloth for last year's production, and they can't get rid of them. I mean, I have known these people to burn them to get rid of them. And they'll fill up a back room somewhere. And so they're delighted when I come along and I'm willing to transport away these samples, which you see here, which explains why every single wine bag is unique. It doesn't look like any others. And if you... I'm trying to sell these to some retail stores here, and they say, okay, well, I'll take 24 of these. I say, I'm sorry. There's just one of those. That's it. Okay. So there we are. So we're winding up here. The IRI sets out to equip residents or poverty-stricken communities in Israel. You can read it better than me. I see. So what I'm talking about here, the model that I'm using now, I started in 1998 in Pakistan. Fun?
You started in 1988 in Pakistan.
Yeah. Oh, did I? Yeah, thank you very much. As Roberta said, the project that I started in Pakistan in 1989. In the project that I started some years ago in Pakistan, added to the time I've been in India, that gets us to 25 years that I've been using the model. I've only been in India this time since 2004. And I haven't talked a lot about the model itself. I've told you about my prejudice about what development is, and one of my pillars of understanding is that development, the uncovering, can only be done by the people in the community. I can't do it. I can go in there with ideas, but I can't communicate with all those people, and I can't make those ideas work. In other words, I can't do this. It has to be done by the community involved. And I've followed this religiously in Pakistan and India with very gratifying results. All right. So I'm not running out of things to say, but I will continue. Dorothy, may I talk for another 25 minutes?
Well, we want to know how we send our checks to you.
I'm sorry, say again.
Our checks, contributions, how do we do that?
Oh, well, yeah. That's a vital question.
Okay. I'm impressed. I've written a check to DIR. Is this going to be okay? Can I give this to Roberta or you?
Yes, but there's it, okay. A begging bowl.
Okay, good.
There's a bowl there, but it's for donations, but you can give it to me, and of course I will send you a tax deductible receipt, or you can mail it for you. You can tell you our address if you want to know.
We can give, if you put any money on that begging bowl, we can give receipts which are tax deductible. The government has allowed us to do that. Bob?
Well, in addition to, and I wanted to just mention what we can do and might be doing, in addition to writing checks to DIR. And the other thing is, one of the things that you mentioned, and when it got to dealing with the standing water ponds, and you talked about the roof that leaks every monsoon, and is that this work, to me, and this is what I think is the most difficult for Americans. This work, to me, involves such a fundamental rethinking of the way we approach life. That life which those people that Frederick was talking about in sitting under their leaking roof, we would say that's a function of inertia, of an incredible level of inertia that we don't experience in our lives, and that's not good. But that, to me, is... I think there's a real important rethinking about the idea, the ideology of progress, which we have all got in our bones, been raised on, and in a culture that the idea of progress is anywhere close to being the same motivating concept that it has been for Americans for the last several hundred years. They got 5,000 years of another set of ideas that don't involve that at all. And so the work that Frederick's doing in making it the middle word, indigenous, stuff that's happening, grows out of actually some different thinking. And so Frederick, one of the things why I love him is because he's able to approach it just like he's a total Anglo person, right? Better than I am in many ways, more articulate for sure. And but he has been able to translate that to a level where it works in a culture that doesn't. It's not, again, not just buying our technology. It's not even buying our ideology of progress in order for them to be successful. And that's what I think is really marvelous about what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you, Mom.
Follow up by something. We are so proud of you, Frederick.
You should be.
We wanted to give you a certificate of excellence for making a difference in the lives of so many people.